the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, Dave Pacheco from the Southern Utah Wilderness Association.
Alliance?
Yes, that too. I just realized, as soon as I said association, I realized it's a long, okay.
We'll call it SUA from
Take
here
two,
on out.
Since I was away last week. Dave Pacheco from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, or SUA, joins us in the first part of the show to discuss what might happen to the Bears Ears National Monument and what impacts the new administration may have on a larger scale on all of our public lands and wilderness.
Then, in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Florence Williams. She's the author of the recently released book, The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. For centuries, poets and philosophers extolled the benefits of a walk in the woods. Beethoven drew inspiration from rocks and trees, Wordsworth composed while tromping over the heath, and Nikola Tesla conceived the electric motor while visiting a park. Intrigued by our storied renewal in the natural world, Florence Williams set out to uncover the science behind nature's positive effects on the brain. She joins us in the second half of the show to discuss her book, The Nature Fix.
And if we have some time at the end of the show, we'll give you a little update on what's called the shed antler closure. Do I have that right now?
Yeah.
Shed antler closure.
Yes.
We talked about that, the fact that people like to go out and collect antlers that have been dropped by
That's
deer,
right.
elk, moose. And how that activity has been closed till April 1st or so.
Mm-hmm,
so.
First, yeah.
But people are still trying to do it. They got caught. We'll give you the details. Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW, This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
G'day, Ian from Campos Coffee. We're new to Park City and a supporter of KPCW. At Campos, we source our beans direct from the farmers and invest in social projects in all our farming communities. Our coffee blends are roasted in small batches and delivered each day. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort. CamposCoffee.com.
Morning Edition and Morning News with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Park City Hospital, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, the Promontory Foundation, and All Seasons Resort Lodging.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability and why environmental protection is more important now than it's ever been. Right, I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is our first guest, Dave Pacheco. He is with SUA, otherwise known as the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And he's here to talk about SUA's opinions on our new administration and what impacts they may have on our public lands and wilderness. Dave, thanks for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start. Let's get right into it. We mentioned Bears Ears in the introduction. Bears Ears is now a national monument, let's call it, for now, but it's at risk. Would you agree with that and say that with the new administration, that designation as a national monument is at risk?
Well, I'd say that it's at risk for public discourse, I would say.
Okay.
The monument itself and the way that we get national monuments is through a law called the Antiquities Act, mm-hmm. which was passed by Congress back in 1906 when Theodore Roosevelt wanted new national parks, and the Congress refused to give them to him. So they gave him a lesser protective designation authority, the ability to make national monuments. That's a statutory ability that presidents can use. So it's not so easy to get rid of them. One president has never been successful at completely eliminating a national monument that another president has made. There have been instances where certain national monuments have been reduced in size, and then later on Congress actually added more acreage to them and made them national parks. So this is really untested water, so I wouldn't really say that it's at risk. It's certainly the rhetoric that flies around here in Utah mostly makes it appear that way, but I would call that a false narrative or an alternative fact.
Well, I would agree that it's at risk for a lot of discourse, and we know that this president can be very combative in a very legal sense, and it wouldn't surprise me. Let's put it this way, Dave. It would not surprise me if he attempted to unwind this. Very, like you say, it's a very complicated process, and it's never been done before. But that doesn't mean that that this president, you know, wouldn't want to be the first.
That's possible.
Okay.
That's certainly possible. And I think what you hit on there briefly is that an intermediary step, should the president act, would be legal action. The Native American groups who proposed this national monument would certainly object to it. And I think you'd see it tied up in the courts for a while. So I don't think we're losing Bears Ears National Monument as we now know it anytime real soon.
Okay.
The other thing that we've been hearing in the news is that, you know, Trump himself likely and Ryan Zinke both are relatively supportive of public lands in general and are not supportive of kind of privatizing those or bringing those to the states. Do you think that'll play into this?
I hope so. The record of Ryan Zinke, his voting record in the 2 years that he has been a representative for environmental issues is pretty dismal. But he does have this statement and this position of wanting to keep public lands in public hands. One of the things that we fear is that although they may not favor turning over ownership of the public lands from the federal government to the state governments, they may try to get what they want through other means, essentially turning over control and management and regulatory authority over the environmental laws that permit things like oil and gas and fossil fuel developments. If they turn that control of the regulations over to the states, the standard drops very low, and they may essentially get what they want by not turning over the public land. So that's a fear that I think we should pay attention to.
Now explain, you know, what the difference would be if these lands were turned over to the states in a hypothetical situation here, because we hear a lot of talk about this in Utah. What would be the difference between, you know, the federal ownership and the state ownership, and what would you expect that to look like?
I think it would be a dramatic difference. Essentially, if the state were to gain control and or ownership of these lands, the parochial interests would come to bear. People who want to make money off the lands are closer here in the state. They're closer to the state legislature, closer to the governor. There's a reason we have national environmental laws, and that's because back in the day, states were failing. States could not, and proved that they could not manage the environment that clearly crosses state borders. I mean, we're not talking about issues that are defined by straight lines on a map that the state boundaries adhere to. We're talking about national environmental laws that set a high bar for a reason, so that there is some sort of control and that there is some sort of regulation from on top that states failed to give in the first place. So I would say that the evidence is in the past. When Ohio was in charge of managing the water in their state, the Cuyahoga River caught fire, and hence we have the Clean Water Act.
Right.
And I think it just, the closer you get to the decision-making, the closer you get to corruption and to money speaks louder, and that's really where the problem is. That's why we have national environmental laws.
Right, and many times there's not enough money anyway within these states to properly fund protection, conservation of a wilderness or these public lands.
That's correct. It's very expensive to manage public lands, and the evidence was very clear when the state pushed its legislation in 2012 to take the federal lands and give them to the state. There were a lot of studies done. The state actually commissioned the economic departments from several of the universities in Utah, and that report was handed back a couple of years ago, saying that only in the instance where the price of oil stays at a higher level would the state be able to make enough money to break even financially. And as we know, since that report came out, the price of oil, which is a worldwide traded commodity, has tanked. And right now, we would be in the red trying to manage these lands here in Utah.
We're speaking with Dave Pacheco. He is with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. We're talking about Bears Ears National Monument, public lands protection, federal versus state management of them. Dave, let's loop back to Bears Ears and this national monument designation. How does a national monument designation, say, differ from other types of classifications? Wilderness designation. You tell us all the different designations that might possibly fit and how a national monument designation works.
Yeah, there are a lot of different classifications, and wilderness designation is a status that only the U.S. Congress can give. Wilderness, think of it as the high bar. Wilderness says no permanent development, where man is a visitor who does not remain, where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man. Those are the words of the Wilderness Act, and it is a high bar, and that's why it's hard to get. We've been working to get over 9 million acres of Bureau of Land Management land, mostly the Red Rock Desert country in Utah, designated as wilderness for a long time. We're in it for the long haul, and we'll continue to work for that. There are lesser designations, and national monuments are one of those designations. It's a designation that doesn't go through Congress. As I said before, it is a presidential declaration. And interestingly enough, hearkening back to 1906, the reason that we have national monuments then and now is exactly the same. Essentially, when Congress fails to act on lands that need decision-making, the president has a backup strategy, and that is he can unilaterally say national monument. And it's not that it's just a president himself saying that. He takes information from the public, and that's very much what happened in this case, where the Secretary of Interior came to Utah and heard from all sides, heard from all the different Native American groups, heard from the San Juan County commissioners and people who lived down in Bluff and Blanding, and people who came from all over who spoke about the monument. It's a public process. And as such, national monuments are kind of a hodgepodge of management. So they aren't wilderness. They are not that high bar. They are what presidents declare them to be. Monuments are specific. They are specifically to be protecting scientific, scenic, and cultural resources that are in danger. And in this case, those cultural resources were really part of the equation. These are Native American ancestral homelands. These Native Americans had been living there for thousands and thousands of years up until about 150 years ago. And it's their ancestral sites and their cultural resources that are scattered throughout the area that we now call Bears Ears. And those resources have been in danger of looting and threatened with ATVs running over them, and really just the lack of management that comes very much from folks like the Utah politicians who don't even want to see these agencies having authority or having much of a budget, and they keep cutting their budget, so it's hard for them to manage them. So this monument is designed specifically to protect those resources that were in danger. And the scenic resource goes without saying. The scenic resource is spectacular in this part of the state, where the land is very, very rugged, and that's why there's nobody living out there, because it's really hard to get there, and there's no water. It's very low water resources, and the only thing that locals can do is graze their cow out there, other than enjoy the scenic beauty, protect it for what it is, protect those cultural resources, and that's what the Native Americans asked for in this case. So monuments are a real specific designation depending on who's asking for it and what resources are being protected. Okay, this one's designed for those cultural resources.
So who does this fall under responsibility of? Is it Department of Interior that's going to be increasing their funding and protection of the Bears Ears?
So the jurisdiction remains the same. This land was mostly managed by the Bureau of Land Management and a portion of it by the National Forest Service. The jurisdiction doesn't change. It stays federal land. It is just managed for specific resources that were identified in the proclamation that made Bears Ears a national monument. And as far as funding is concerned, that's up to the Congress. If the Utah politicians get their way, this monument won't be funded.
Right.
They'll zero it out.
Sure.
And that'd be a tragedy.
So thinking about the dynamics taking place on a state level here, we're, you know, partway through our very short legislative session here in Utah. What is it that we need to be watching? What's going on in the realm of public lands at the state legislature?
Well, there's a lot going on at the state legislature. Most of the damage, especially around Bears Ears, has already been done. In the first opening days of the legislative session, the legislature rushed through a resolution asking now President Trump to dismantle, reduce, or eliminate the Bears Ears National Monument. That's already been done. They passed another resolution shortly thereafter that was very similar to reduce the size of the 20-year-old Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Both of these would be very bad moves for the state. Those monuments have received, you know, international recognition. The communities down in these towns are doing well. Recently, the Escalante Chamber of Commerce went to Washington, D.C. to meet with our delegation and to meet with officials out in Washington to let them know that they have a labor shortage down there and that the town is doing very well. And I think what this really gets at is change. And is there change going on around us in the world? For sure. And will we adapt to that change and tackle the problems that we see in front of us and adapt to a changing world? That's yet to be determined. And I think that in many respects, our state legislature is stuck in a philosophy of we can graze our way out of our problems, and that's just not reality. It's not economic reality, and it's not environmental reality. And there are a lot of people who would just love to come to our state and visit the beauty that we have. We see it with the Mighty Five campaign and how successful that's been.
Mighty Five campaign?
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, the state of Utah launched a Mighty Five National Parks campaign over the last few years around the country and internationally to attract visitors to our national parks here. Have been greatly successful. Our parks are overrun with tourists now because there's so much advertising going on out there. And strangely enough, those national parks, four of the five national parks, were prior to becoming parks, which the Congress made them such, they were national monuments. The individual presidents saw the importance of declaring Arches as a national park and Capitol Reef as Arches as a national monument and Capitol Reef as a national monument and Bryce as a national monument and Zion as a national monument. Presidents did that over the objection of the Utah politicians back in the day. And now we're celebrating that by advertising, come to see Utah, come to see the beauty, come to see our parks. It's biting the hand that feeds them, and it's they're not dealing with economic reality. And that is coming back to haunt them in a lot of different ways. You saw the outdoor recreation show,
right?
Outdoor retailer show just left the state over this. We look at it as embarrassing. The decisions that are made at the state legislature are not those feelings of the general state of Utah. We value our public lands here, and we value the diversity that it can bring. And
right.
That's certainly not how the state legislature is acting.
Okay.
So, Dave, we've got about 4 minutes left and wanted to talk to you a little bit more about the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance in general, what it is that you do and what the issues are that you focus on. So maybe start with your mission and spend a couple minutes telling us about what it is you do.
Sure. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance was founded in 1983. Our mission is the protection of the wildlands at the heart of the Colorado Plateau for the benefit of all Americans. And by protection, we mean through legislative and administrative means. So what that means is we work to pass legislation. We have a bill that we've identified over 9 million acres of wild public lands in Utah called America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. We've been supporting that bill, originally introduced into Congress by then-Representative Wayne Owens of Salt Lake City. That bill has never gained the support of the majority of the Utah delegation, and we continue to work. We continue to build national support for these issues. There is a national constituency to protect these public lands that belong to all Americans, and we continue to work for legislative solutions, and we hope that that will, you know, become the law one day. And that's really our main goal, is to protect those places. Legislative is the strongest sort of protections you can get, because you get the wilderness designation.
And
much like the High Uintas and the Mount Timpanogos and the Mount Olympus wilderness areas that we know right in our backyard.
Okay.
So how can people get involved? Do you use volunteers? Do you have membership? Give us an idea of how folks can get involved with the SUA.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit membership organization. Over 75% of the funds that we get come directly from individuals who care. And we encourage membership through SUA. You can find us at SUA.org and easily join in. We have many volunteer opportunities in the form mostly of activism, so helping us be a spokesperson at a local festival or fair. We often come up and we do Park Silly Sunday Market once a year, so that's always fun for us. And things like that. We get involved. We get citizens involved in writing letters to the local papers. That's a very effective way to get your voice heard, to write opinion pieces and letters to the editor. We encourage folks to write to their congresspeople, to make phone calls, to attend town hall meetings. We want people to get involved actively and to be spokespeople for standing up for public lands and the values that they hold. And the public lands really are Utah. That's who we are. We are a product of the land. I grew up here and went hunting and fishing with my grandpa down in San Pete County. And that's how I gained my personal desire to protect these places. And I think that's very common for most Utahns. We have that background, and we do care. And SUA is an organization that allows us to express that desire and express that care for the land. So becoming involved as a member, getting on our email list, very easy on our homepage, liking Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance on Facebook. There's a lot of different ways to get involved, and you can see it when people show up in droves at rallies and speak for these places they care about.
And I would highlight the attendance of town hall meetings by when congressmen come back to their districts. I mean, Rob Bishop is our congressman here, and go to his website. Telling our listeners, go to Rob Bishop's website. It is robbishop.house.gov, and look on his schedule and see when he's going to be back in town. And if he's having a meeting, go. I mean, that's probably the most effective, one of the more effective ways to getting their attention. Writing and calling can be effective. But now, activism in the form of showing up at these meetings and voicing your opinions is going to be really critical.
And just as an extension on that, demanding a meeting.
Yeah.
The Utah politicians recently, or at least the Utah Republican Party, came out and said, we're not going to hold any more town hall meetings. And so it's up to us to demand those meetings and to request those in-person meetings while the representative is back in his home district. That's fairly often, and that schedule is on Congressman Bishop's page when he's back in the district, because usually when we get a holiday, usually get a whole week. So so they're usually around during the holidays, so you can track them that way.
Track them that way. All right. Dave Pacheco with Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, SUA, www.nationalmonuments.org. Thanks again for taking the time to chat with us this morning, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters.
That's right. And then we'll be back with Florence Williams, who's the author of The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative.
It's The Screen Earth. Stay tuned.
Additional funding for programming is funded in part by Summit Injury Law, Park City's personal injury law firm, summitinjurylawyers.com, Gorgoza Park, lift serve tubing, many snowmobile rides and more, gorgozapark.com, Kathleen Barlow, now with Raymond James & Associates Incorporated, kathleen.barlow@raymondjames.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the second half of the show is Florence Williams, the author of The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. For centuries, poets and philosophers extolled the benefits of a walk in the woods. Beethoven drew inspiration from rocks and trees, Wordsworth composed while tramping over the heath, and Nikola Tesla conceived the electric motor while visiting a park. Intrigued by our storied renewal in the natural world, Florence Williams set out to uncover the science behind nature's positive effects on the brain. And here she is joining us on the phone today. Florence, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, good morning. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with this. Tell us about your motivation to write this book. What got you started on this topic?
What got me started was my own sort of personal journey from being someone who is very nature connected. I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and had lived for 2 decades in the Rocky Mountains, on trails every day, hearing the birds.
Something our listeners can relate to.
Yeah.
Exactly, in beautiful Utah. And my husband took a job in Washington, D.C., and so we moved to this sort of hyper-urb where I really felt my brain and body, you know, sort of under assault in some ways. Like this cortisol bomb had gone off in my brain. You know, the noise pollution was super intense. And, I was feeling anxious and I wasn't sleeping so well. And I just began to wonder, you know, how much of this is because of, you know, what I've lost in terms of my connection to nature, and what does the science say about how our environments really affect us?
Well, I think many of us, you know, can identify with those feelings you had about, you know, nature helping you feel more relaxed, or rather lack of it, making you feel a little more anxious. And we generally have that feeling, yeah, nature makes us a little bit happier and maybe a little more relaxed. What data is out there to show this, you know, rather than just a general gut feeling?
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you said, first, it was kind of the realm of the poets and philosophers who would talk about how great it was to walk outside. You know, Thoreau would walk 4 hours a day, and Wordsworth would compose his poetry while he was walking. But it's really only been in the last, I would say, 10 or 20 years that scientists have started to try to measure kind of what those differences are. And even more specifically, in the last 5 years that we've had kind of portable brain imaging, you know, techniques and tools. And so what they're doing is they're sending, you know, subjects out into the woods or into the wilderness or into various parks And then comparing kind of what they see in terms of brain waves and cortisol levels, stress hormones, blood pressure, heart rate variability, you know, these different ways of kind of monitoring and measuring the nervous system, and comparing what's going on with people in the park to people in a city. And the changes are actually pretty dramatic. So they're seeing a real sort of drop in stress levels, and at the same time, an increase in biomarkers kind of associated with calm, alert, creativity, for example, in the frontal lobe of the brain. You know, that activation is kind of going down. Other parts of the brain are getting activated that are associated more with empathy or creativity, or even just connection to other people. So it looks like even the benefits of nature go sort of far beyond even what, you know, sort of the poets would talk about in terms of creativity. There's actually a lot more going on.
So, okay, so now we have science to back up the therapeutic effect, the physical healing aspects of being exposed to nature. When is the health industry going to embrace this? And when will I see a 5% discount on my monthly health insurance, you know, if I can show that I spend X amount of hours outdoors or somehow, you know, taking advantage of the therapeutic effects?
Yeah, that is such a great question. I mean, other countries, I would say they are farther ahead of us.
They are.
In terms of how the medical establishment and the public health fields are sort of embracing nature. For example, in Denmark, people who are very depressed or burned out from their jobs and unable to work are able to have these wonderfully funded sort of garden therapy, horticulture therapy, kind of wood therapy programs where they can go hang out in nature for, you know, 3 hours a day in some cases, and then go back to work. You know, so as an intervention, nature has kind of been proven to be incredibly effective. But in this country, you know, we still don't quite believe in preventative care the way other countries do that have more socialized medicine. People are still sort of, I would say the institutions and the insurance industry are still kind of awaiting more evidence, bigger studies, you know, case control studies, which are sometimes sort of hard to do, you know, in nature because there's so many variables. So in terms of waiting for the evidence, I think, you know, we may still have a long way to go. I will say that the VA, Veterans Administration, is now doing a really big study looking at sort of wilderness and nature therapy because it has been shown to be quite effective, at least, you know, in smaller studies. So at some point, we may see the VA kind of embracing some of these treatment interventions, which I think would be a really big step.
And nature has been proven to be not only important to, like, mental health and well-being, but also really direct, like, physical results, certain kinds of cells that help you stay healthy. You point out that doctors are, in some cases, prescribing time outside in nature or in parks to kids who suffer with certain issues, right?
That's right. That's happening in a number of countries, and it's actually beginning to happen here. I think there are 35 programs in this country where doctors are partnering with park agencies to do prescriptions for their patients. In my city in D.C., Unity Healthcare is a big medical facility here. There's a doctor who's prescribing time in parks actually to children because he has seen these kind of chronic health problems like obesity and diabetes and anxiety that are just not so easy to solve. And it's not like, you know, medical school really necessarily teaches you how to solve them. And he's found it by prescribing more time in parks to kids. They also get their families out, and that it's really beneficial for the whole family.
So Chris and I were wondering who does this right? You know, like we're not doing it right in our country, but we were talking before the show about, you know, is there a city in the U.S. that's on the front lines, or, you know, what about other countries?
Yeah, you mentioned Denmark. Are there others?
One thing I love about Denmark and other countries in Scandinavia is that they're starting early. You know, they understand that children especially need time in nature where they can just kind of roam free, engage in more exploratory play that has been shown to be incredibly important for kids' social and emotional development. you know, not just their mental health, but also the way they engage with other children, the way they solve problems and do teamwork. And I think it's something like 10% of all preschoolers in countries like Finland are actually going to forest kindergarten. I would Wow. love to see that happen here, because if you can establish a really strong bond between kids and the natural world, we know that that bond will last their entire lifetimes. And they'll be able to kind of look to nature for comfort and joy and delight and learning their entire lives. Whereas if you don't foster that nature connection, you actually are at risk of losing it.
Yeah, I thought we might actually have something like that here, don't we, now in Park City?
We do, I think.
Preschool or kindergarten-based learning, outdoor learning, where all of their classes are outdoors.
Yeah, I think there
they're learning about math, science, English, by being outdoors. That's what you're talking about, Florence, that kind of...
That's what I'm talking about. In these schools that I visited, the kids are outside probably 90% of the time. You know, and these are not countries that have particularly great climates.
Right.
You know, it's wet and cold in Northern Europe and in Scotland. And they have a saying, you know, that there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing. Mm-hmm. And so these little kids are totally well equipped. You know, they've got their big galoshes on and they've got their rain suits and their snow suits. And boy, they are just having the time of their lives. They're just having a blast. And we are seeing a little bit of a movement now in this country. More preschools are embracing it. Of course, though, we still have, you know, very academic kindergarten, which is pretty controversial because we're expecting these little kids in kindergarten to sit at a desk with four walls and a pencil, you know, and start learning their reading and writing, you know, at age 5 and 6. And the data in Europe really shows that if kids are outside during that time and learning other skills, that they catch up to the academics within a couple of years, but they far outstrip their other peers in terms of these other measures of like problem solving and teamwork.
We're speaking with Florence Williams. She's the author of Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. So, okay, sounds good to me. What's the pushback? Who's pushing back on this? Is our new Secretary of Education a fan of teaching outdoors or this style of teaching?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure what Betsy DeVos's particular feeling about nature education is. I do think that it's not so much that there is necessarily a villain out there saying, don't go into nature. I think it's more just the general pattern of modern life, right?
Right.
Is that we are increasingly inside. And it's not even a conscious decision. And that's kind of the point I try to make in the book. It's that this incredibly radical shift, you know, in our human habitat has occurred, where we're not only moving to cities, you know, in droves, but we're really moving inside. And yet it's happened while we've barely noticed it or remarked upon it. And I think that's a problem. Part of it is technology. You know, there's just really fun things to do inside now.
Sure.
Wasn't necessarily the case when we were kids and we wanted to be outside.
Well,
so
I can watch.
We just have to be more mindful.
Right. I can watch the Nature Channel. Florence. I can.
You can watch trees on your television.
I can strap on some virtual reality and be outdoors. You know, not being
Exactly. There are people trying to create nature experiences using virtual reality. But my time in Japan really convinced me that that's not so adequate, because what we really need in order to feel the full kind of physiological and stress benefits of nature is we need to engage with our environments using all of our senses. Mm. And this is something the Japanese are really good at. So they have ways to just, you know, engage our sense of smell, engage our sense of sound, you know, look for particular patterns, drink bark tea, you know, use all of our senses.
Sure.
And what that does is it just makes us mindful of being in that environment, which seems to give us just a quicker kind of bang for the buck in terms of feeling better.
And while you were there, you learned about something. I love this phrase called forest bathing. So
yeah,
describe what that
right.
is.
Forest bathing is the practice in Japan. And it doesn't involve taking off your clothes. It's just, you know, going into the woods, even for a little while, and just focusing really on all those senses. So it's a way to engage with the environment, to to be mindful of what you're hearing and listening. So, you know, taking those earbuds out, putting your phone away, and really listening to the birds or the creek, and almost instantly, you know, it will lower your blood pressure and then boost your mood for the whole day, according to the science.
Yeah, which Japanese children need a lot of, because they're also put under a lot of pressure in their educational system. You know, from what I've seen.
Yeah, well, the Japanese, right, exactly. They came to industrialization really quickly. The Japanese workers are very stressed out, incredibly long hours. Japanese kids are, very long hours at school. And in fact, one of the kind of surprising things we're seeing from this move indoors is that in parts of Asia, 90% of teenagers are nearsighted and have to wear glasses.
Hmm.
And that's actually because they're not getting enough vitamin D in their retina.
Wow.
So there are like these little subtle effects that we're finding, and it kind of makes you realize, huh, you know, I wonder what else is doing to our brains.
So what does all of this mean for our future and our connection with nature? You talk about this mass migration into cities. More of us are living in cities than ever before, and we have less easy access to nature. We're more focused on our technology. You know, is this something we can get back? And should work to do so?
I believe that we can, if we're more conscious about what kind of exposure we need to nature, and we start to sort of understand that it actually really is critical for our well-being and for our sense of being human, that we can learn to engage with the natural world wherever we are. So it doesn't have to be really spectacular. So I have now learned that I need nature. I need exposure every day, and I can get it in Washington.
Right.
You know, it's maybe not like as much as I would like, but it will get me through the day. You know, if I can go for a walk under some trees and you know, watch the great blue heron, you know, land on the C&O Canal. Nature exists, you know, everywhere. It exists in our backyard. I was recently talking to someone who specializes in kind of looking at things under a microscope in her backyard and seeing beauty and awe there. So, you know, even in like a blade of grass, you can find a sort of amazing world of wonder and awe, but you have to kind of look for it and make the effort.
So how much is enough? You know, you say you need it every day. If you're living in a city, like, can you get out once a month and call it good? Or, you know, is there a recommendation, like, how long these benefits last?
Hmm.
We're
like,
so
is there
spoiled
a daily
here.
Minimum dose.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Minimum daily dose.
Minimum daily dose. Yeah, no one has really kind of dialed it down to that level yet. And what I have learned is that I think it's very variable. You know, there are times in our lives when we may need a closer, deeper, more intimate connection with nature. You know, for example, especially if, you know, we're dealing with grief or trauma, there may be times when kind of a deeper immersion into nature can be super helpful. But, you know, if we're just kind of like going about our daily lives and, you know, trying not to be like overly nerve jangled, you know, by email and traffic, you know, just a quick dose, like 15, 20 minutes, you know, it can do it.
Right. I'll say it. I recently had my father passed away, and my brothers and sisters, we got together. We live in southern New Jersey, and following the day after the funeral, where did we go? We decided to go. We went to the beach, and that was not only a source of kind of family remembrance, but also the beach has a wonderful, like you say, it's has a restorative quality to it, has a reflective quality to it. Just the beach, and that the value of that is difficult to quantify.
Well, that's a beautiful story, and I think it raises another point, which is that when we're in beautiful places with other people, it can also really strengthen those bonds. It's a way to be somewhere together and
right.
share an experience.
Right.
So we've got a couple more minutes left, and I wanted to ask about something that's really relevant to a lot of our community here in Utah. Air pollution is a difficult issue, especially in the Wasatch Front and the Salt Lake Valley, and we often have some of the worst air pollution in the country, unfortunately. So how does something like that impact us, impact our health, impact our connection with the outdoors, what does that do beyond, you know, I think we think, oh, you know, it's bad for our lungs.
Right.
We kind of leave it at that. But I know that there are some additional impacts.
Yeah, I do have a chapter. I have a chapter on smell where I talk quite a bit about air pollution. And I also talk about noise pollution, by the way, because for city dwellers, that's also a big impact. We actually know, unfortunately, we know that both of those things, noise pollution and air pollution, really affect our brains very quickly. You know, the nose is a sort of a direct highway into the brain. And there's some very kind of, I think, disconcerting evidence that pollution particles, you know, enter our brains really quickly. And, you know, they've been linked to dementia. They've been linked to neurological developmental damage in children and infants. And of course, we know that particle pollution is quite directly linked to death, you know, from many different causes, actually, related to cardiovascular health and respiratory health. So I think it's actually a huge problem and will undoubtedly be one of the great challenges of the 21st century.
So with all of this in mind, you know, what do you have? Obviously, your book just came out and you're working on promoting this now. But what do you see kind of coming out of this, or what do you see working on next?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I do feel very, very passionate about the importance to conserve beautiful public lands so that people can have wilderness spaces to go to. You know, it's this incredible legacy we in America have. And I'd love to see us just cherish it and recognize how actually important it is kind of for our civilization, you know. It's kind of ironic that civilization needs wilderness, but I do feel very strongly about that now after researching this book. And I also feel very passionate about the importance of getting children outside. So those are two directions I'd like to keep focusing on.
Fantastic.
Well, it's ironic that you mentioned that because our first guest was from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and we talked all about the importance of protecting public lands.
Well, you're certainly having that conversation in Utah right now.
Oh, it's not over. Believe me.
Right.
So it's
you guys are kind of at the front lines. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the name of the book is Nature Fix: Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. The author is Florence Williams. And Florence, again, you have a website or so people can go to learn more about yourself and your writings?
I do, yeah. Thanks for asking. It's just florencewilliams.com.
No. Perfect.
That's an easy one. Straightforward.
check it out.
All right. And check out the book, The Nature Fix. Again, thanks so much for joining us, Florence, this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day and
Thank you.
For a hike.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks.
Will do.
Let's take another break for some underwriters and sponsors. We come back. We got maybe one news item we can squeeze in.
That's right.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dr. Renato Saltz, proud to support KPCW. At Saltz Plastic Surgeons Pavitoria, we offer cosmetic surgeries of the face and body, as well as non-surgical procedures such as CoolSculpting, laser resurfacing, Botox, and fillers. More information at saltzplasticsurgery.com or 655-6612.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Okay.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We've got a couple minutes left, and we wanted to give you an update on the antler shed story. We had
breaking
talked about
news.
Yeah, breaking news. So we had talked about how people, you know, collect these dropped antlers in the late winter and early spring. And the Sierra, Utah banned that practice
Deer,
because
elk,
of the
moose.
That's right. These ungulates.
Is that what they are?
Yep.
They're ungulates and their antlers
animals.
Shed every winter.
That's right. Yeah. Like toward the end of the winter, they'll shed these antlers and people like to, you know, go out and collect them. They'll sell them to be used for decoration or for dog chews or whatever else.
Right.
And this practice has become incredibly popular. And this year, for the first time ever, DWR kind of had to say, hey, these animals are under such stress this winter with the really cold temps and the really deep snow. They're weak and they're low on energy, so they can't be disturbed. You know, just getting up to run 100 feet away from somebody might kind of do them in at this point, right?
So right.
DWR made this decision, and that was at the beginning of the month, and we've got an update.
Right. And so since then, they put out a little news item. They say they have caught 16 people so far for violating this closure. The unlawful take of protected wildlife is a Class B misdemeanor. The violators now face fines as high as $1,000. Our officers cited these individuals, he said, after watching them look for and then pick up the antlers. So they were watched by DWR officials. Or we caught them with actual antlers in their possessions. In two separate cases, an officer watched an individual pick antlers up and then stash them away.
Oh.
See, they were going to, so that's how they were
hide
trying to get around it.
Own.
Yeah. Right. Pick, still go out and gather them, but not leave with them, just hide them so he'd come back later. So as the violator walked off the mountain, the officer was there to greet him, and then they admitted that they did that. And actually, they went back and followed their footprints, too, to the antlers.
Jeez.
So people are still trying to get around that.
Yep.
Either by just going out and still going and maybe identifying, maybe you can just GPS the location and maybe come back, right?
Yeah.
You don't even have to pick them up and hide them. If just take your chances and GPS it, and that way, April 1st, when this, I think that's when the...
Yeah. It is when the ban ends, but until April 15th, actually, you have to have the certificate,
okay,
which is a training that you do online. I've done it. It takes like 15 minutes, and you just kind of learn about your impacts, some of the ethics around it, what the rules are. So the people with the certificate have that window from April 1st to 15th to collect before it's open to the general public.
All right, and if you see others who look like they're collecting shed antlers, you can call a hotline. The hotline number is 1-800-662-DEER.
All right, I like it.
That's 662-DEER.
DWR consultants certainly use everyone's help on this one. So we need to wrap up.
We got to get a couple more underwriters in. We'll be right back. This is Green Earth.
Hi, this is Molly from Recycle Utah. Did you know that Recycle Utah advocates for eco-effective change at state, county, and city levels? Through our advocacy program, we talk trash with our Utah elected officials. For information on any of our advocacy campaigns or to find a sample letter to your legislator, visit recycleutah.org.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years, and we support KPCW.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel. 565-4730, ParkCityAirCruiseAndTravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, ParkCityBikeDemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Well, it's time to thank the underwriters who make our show possible, and they include Vail Epic Promise,
Republic Services,
Recycle Utah,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain.
You can join us on Facebook, KPCW This Green Earth, or email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas to This Green